It's official. The Democrats announced two articles of impeachment against President Donald Trump.
We must be clear. No one, not even the president, is above the law.
Trump insists he did nothing wrong. Also today, the president meets with the top diplomat from Russia. A former White House advisor says it's not clear what's on the agenda.
It's just Donald Trump once again saying, I've got to talk to Russians. I need to wrap myself in this idea that the U.S. and Russia somehow can be partners again, even though, again, there's no substantive foundation that you could establish such a partnership on.
Also, a Nobel Peace Prize winner accepts his award, but it's complicated. And in the U.K. this week, it's a Love Actually election. Really, actually. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Good to have you here. High crimes and misdemeanors. The Democrats made it official this morning during a brief but significant news conference at the Capitol building.
Today, in service to our duty to the Constitution and to our country, the House Committee on the Judiciary is introducing two articles of impeachment charging the President of the United States, Donald J. Trump, with committing high crimes and misdemeanors.
Jerry Nadler, chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, laid out the two charges against the president. First, abuse of power. Democrats say Trump pressured Ukraine to interfere in next year's presidential election by announcing an investigation into a political rival here at home, Joe Biden. The second article of impeachment, obstruction of Congress. Specifically, that's a charge connected with the White House's efforts to deny Congress access to key witnesses and documents in their investigation. Here's Nadler again.
A president who declares himself above accountability, above the American people, and above Congress's power of impeachment, which is meant to protect against threats to our democratic institutions, is a president who sees himself as above the law. We must be clear. No one, not even the president, is above the law.
Throughout the impeachment inquiry, Republicans claim the process was unfair, partly because it's been rushed. The chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, Adam Schiff, addressed that.
The argument, why don't you just wait, amounts to this. Why don't you just let him cheat in one more election? Why not let him cheat just one more time? Why not let him have foreign help just one more time?
President Trump preempted the Democrats. On Twitter, he called impeachment sheer political madness and said he did nothing wrong. Republican members of Congress held their own news conference this morning, and they echoed Trump's message, saying that impeachment is really about the Democrats trying to prevent Trump from being reelected. Here's Republican Congressman Steve Scalise of Louisiana.
Make no mistake, they wouldn't be talking about this if they felt confident in their field of candidates. More and more Democrats are talking about getting in the race for president to this day. But ultimately, they ought to trust the American people with the election and not still try to reverse the results of the last election.
The House Judiciary Committee meets tomorrow to debate those two impeachment articles. It's looking like a full vote in the House could come before Christmas. At the heart of the impeachment story is President Trump's conduct with respect to Ukraine and Russia. Today, administration officials played host to Russia's foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov. In a joint news conference with Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, Lavrov was asked about Russian meddling in the 2016 presidential election. Here's some of what he had to say through an interpreter.
All speculations about our alleged interference in domestic processes in the United States are baseless. There are no facts that would support that. We did not see these facts. No one has given us this proof because simply it does not exist.
After that denial from Lavrov, Pompeo was asked about the possibility of declassifying communications between U.S. and Russian officials concerning Russian meddling in 2016.
We'll publish all the documents we think appropriate. We think we've shared plenty of facts to show what happened in the 2016 election with our Russian counterparts. We don't think there's any mistake about what really transpired there.
Andrew Weiss served in Republican and Democratic administrations in multiple roles, including as director of Russian affairs on the National Security Council. He's now a vice president with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and joins us from Washington. Andrew, what exactly did we learn about U.S.-Russian relations today?
that a friend of mine likes to joke, the U.S.-Russian relationship is becoming a lot like the show Seinfeld. It's a relationship about nothing. The Russians are, you know, once again, for the 80th millionth time, saying, we didn't do anything in the 2016 election, can't lay a glove on us, show us the proof. And they basically are running circles around the Trump administration. Just the very fact of this meeting happening is a big win for the Kremlin.
I mean, Lavrov's visit to Washington comes just the day after the Ukraine peace summit in Paris, where President Putin sat down with Ukraine's President Zelensky. What do you think that tells us?
It tells us that somebody at the White House simply doesn't know how to either run a proper schedule or how to properly consult with our allies. Yesterday, there was a meeting in Paris hosted by the French president, attended also by the German chancellor, along with the Ukrainian president and the Russian president. And here you have the Russian foreign minister sort of popping into Washington on an overnight flight to do the debriefing of the president of the United States. It's a travesty.
I mean, this meeting had to be about something. What was at the top of the agenda? What did the White House actually want from these meetings with Lavrov?
I think it's better to say, what does Donald Trump want? And Donald Trump has been basically, since the day he took office, chasing after Vladimir Putin and any other Russian official he can corner. And he's, for reasons that are still, I think, thoroughly inexplicable, convinced that the U.S. and Russia can be great partners. And the topic that we're supposed to become partners on shifts over time. There's no foundation for that assertion. But the Russians fully appreciate that the mere fact of having their foreign minister in the Oval Office instead of the German foreign minister, the French foreign minister, let alone Ukrainian President Zelensky, sends the world a message that it's a U.S.-Russian buddies club, and the rest of the world's concerns that the U.S., you know, sometimes claims to care about can all basically be put aside. This is not the way foreign policy is supposed to be conducted. It's all a product of Donald Trump's very personalized approach to coddling authoritarian leaders. It's really not the way the railroad is supposed to be run.
Arms control, did that come up? Because Vladimir Putin offered recently to extend the Strategic Nuclear Weapons Treaty New START. What is Trump's position on New START and what progress was made there?
So this is the last remaining major arms control agreement between the United States and Russia. And the Trump administration, under John Bolton's leadership, has done everything possible to torpedo it. That's not to discount the importance of Russian cheating on other arms control agreements or to suggest that this is a panacea for all that is problematic in the U.S.-Russian relationship. But in this case, the U.S. won't take yes for an answer. The treaty allows the two major parties, the United States and Russia, to agree to a clean 5-year extension. But instead of doing that, the Trump administration has come up with this smokescreen where they say, well, unless we get China into the mix here, we can't negotiate an extension. So that's never going to happen. And so it's a very easy alibi for the Trump people to basically insist that we're doing all we can as the clock runs out.
Andrew Weiss of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
At a ceremony in Oslo today, the Nobel Peace Prize for 2019 was given to Ethiopia's Prime Minister, Abiy Ahmed. The timing for his medal is not great. We'll explain that a bit later. Less than 1,000 miles from Oslo, there was another Nobel laureate at the International Court of Justice in The Hague. Aung San Suu Kyi from Myanmar is taking part in court proceedings on atrocities against the Rohingya people, a Muslim minority. Except to the dismay of many, Suu Kyi is in The Hague to defend Myanmar's military campaign. It was the West African nation of the Gambia that initiated this week's hearings at the ICJ. Gambian Justice Minister Abubakar Tambadou told the courtroom today that something must be done to stop Myanmar's brutal crackdown against the Rohingya.
Every day of inaction means that more people are being killed, more women are being ravaged, and more children are being burnt alive.
YY Nu was also in the courtroom today. She's a Rohingya activist. In 2005, she was 18, and YY and her family were all arrested and imprisoned. She spent the next 7 years in a jail cell, sleeping on the floor. After her release, she earned a law degree and founded two NGOs dedicated to raising the status of women in Myanmar. She's now based in New York at Columbia University, although today, as I said, she's in The Hague. I asked her what was going through her mind seeing Aung San Suu Kyi at today's hearing.
It's really painful for me. At the same time, I'm keeping my hope alive because this is the first time that suffering of our people are being hurt. It is very painful to see that the Nobel Peace Laureate, who used to be my hero and I used to grow up looking up to her as an inspiration. And it is so painful to see that she is in the court and presumably denying the suffering of my people and standing by the side of the military, which are the perpetrators of crimes of genocide.
As far as Aung San Suu Kyi herself, what is your hope from these hearings? Do you hope for some kind of reckoning about how her position has changed?
Yes, I'm very excited and hopeful because the International Court, as it is independent, I am hoping that the outcome of this hearing will lead to actually holding perpetrators accountable and ending impunity and bringing justice and peace for the Rohingya communities and other communities in the country.
There is a fundamental kind of element here in this case, and that's the fact that the word genocide is legally debatable. According to the UN, as you probably know, a genocide takes place when the acts of violence are committed with intent to destroy an ethnic or religious group. And while many of Myanmar's actions do consist of textbook ethnic cleansing, does that make a genocide, in your view?
So there are overwhelming evidence that crimes of genocide may have occurred. So whether it is genocide or not, legal determination for us, it doesn't matter. But what we really need is justice and accountability for the violations, for the suffering.
Yeah, to your point, I mean, the U.S. Treasury Department just today blacklisted four Myanmar military leaders, including the commander-in-chief. It's the toughest action taken yet by Washington against Myanmar. Do you and the Rohingya people, though, feel supported enough by powerful nations and leaders? Or are you still kind of fighting this alone?
You know, this is not just the Rohingya fight, or this is not just the Myanmar fight. This is the fight for the humanity. It is fight for all countries and all beings. So we need more actions from the powerful nations. We need allies to support us and to bring peace and justice for the people.
I mean, the fact that the West African nation of the Gambia filed this lawsuit, it's a majority Muslim country, but it's a small country, not many resources.
Yeah.
And I've seen reports of hundreds of Rohingya refugees in Bangladesh who yesterday gathered on a hill and chanted, "Gambia, Gambia."
Yeah.
What does it mean to you that little Gambia came to the defense of your people in Myanmar?
Yeah, it's fascinating how, you know, small nation can take this big actions and initiative. What I would say is, even if this small nation can take such big actions, why don't the big nation take action? It's so shameful.
Well, I know you come from a politically active Rohingya family that in the past was actually close with Aung San Suu Kyi. In fact, I gather you and much of your family got thrown into prison for years just for being aligned with her pro-democracy movement. Now she's in court in The Hague planning to downplay the violence exacted on your people. So that must make it not just painful for you, but also personal?
Yeah, it is very personal. And my father was a very close political ally to her during the entire democracy movement. And because of that, our family was put in jail. It's very personal, as you said. It's mostly because our family has supported democracy movement in her in particular. So it's really painful. It's really like a betrayal. And how someone can change that much. But now it's the reality that we have to acknowledge that she has walked away from us and from our populations. And this is not acceptable. She should change her attitude. And, you know, she should be leader for all of us, not just the Burmese Buddhists.
YY Nu is a Rohingya activist. She's been speaking with us from The Hague, where the International Court of Justice is holding hearings on possible genocide in Myanmar. YY Nu, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much for including me, too.
Aung San Suu Kyi is not the only controversial recipient of a Nobel Peace Prize. The man who received that honor today faces deep criticism at home. The story of Abiy Ahmed ahead later this hour. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Negotiations at the UN Climate Summit in Madrid stepped up a gear today. Environment and finance ministers have begun to arrive for the high-level portion of COP25, as it's called. So far, the talks have not resolved much. Rich countries responsible for the most carbon emissions have yet to pledge more greenhouse gas cuts than they've already promised. Leaders pointed out that more vulnerable nations are paying the price. Here's the president of COP25, Carolina Schmidt of Chile, speaking through a translator.
Climate change is unfair, unjust. It affects more severely those communities and territories that are more vulnerable. And that is why, because climate change is unfair, we want climate action to be fair.
Of the largest emitters, only the European Union looks poised to set out more ambitious carbon targets at the summit. Thorny technical issues on the summit's agenda still need to be resolved as ministers settle in for the final phase of the talks. Those include setting up the rules for a market to allow countries to sell carbon credits under the Paris Agreement and for how vulnerable nations can get money to help with the impacts of climate change. Patricia Espinosa is the executive secretary of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change.
This year marks the 25th anniversary of UN climate change. Each year at the COP, we're told that the window of opportunity could close soon. Ministers, dear friends, the window of opportunity is closing now.
One conspicuous absence, a high-level representative from the U.S. President Trump triggered the process to withdraw from the Paris Climate Accord last month, but other U.S. leaders stepped in to fill his place. Presidential candidate Michael Bloomberg visited the summit today.
Now, the reason I'm here in Madrid is very simple. I'm here because President Trump is not. I'm here because his administration refuses to lead on climate change, and so others must do the work.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi also made a quick trip to the Madrid summit last week. The climate talks attract thousands of people, not just politicians like Pelosi and Bloomberg, but negotiators, activists, media, and business people. Spain was expecting 25,000 people to show up this year. There is some irony here in that just getting all those people to one place at one time means a pretty big carbon footprint, especially because many of them fly there. That's why many participants try to find more climate-friendly travel options. Swedish activist Greta Thunberg, as you might have heard, crossed the Atlantic by sailboat. Our Berlin-based reporter covering the summit, Rachel Waldholtz, tried what she thought would be a simpler option to get to Madrid, taking the train. But she found out that even as the flight-shaming movement grows, not flying isn't as easy as you might think.
To get from Berlin, where I live, to Madrid, the simplest option is to fly. Discount airlines have made it super easy to hop from one European city to another. A direct flight from Berlin to Madrid takes less than 3 hours and can cost less than $50. That's hard to resist. But an increasingly vocal group of activists want people to look at a different number before they book that flight. It's carbon emissions.
If you have low emissions in your everyday life, you think there is room for the occasional flight.
That's Swedish activist Maya Rosén.
But what most people don't realize is that even if you just go on a yearly flight, you use up your whole carbon dioxide budget.
Rosén co-founded a group called We Stay on the Ground, which has gotten 11,000 people in Sweden to commit to a flight-free 2020. She stopped flying more than a decade ago after seeing Al Gore's movie, An Inconvenient Truth.
I got really scared. I realized that the climate crisis is not something that will affect someone else. It was also risking my own future.
Rosén's group is part of a trend. Over the past few years, there's been a spike in awareness of the climate impact of flying. My flight from Berlin to Madrid, for instance, would release more than 800 pounds of carbon dioxide. That's roughly the total emissions of the average person in Kenya for a year. Airlines are experimenting with electric flights and synthetic fuels to reduce their carbon footprints. But for now, the only way to reduce emissions from flying is to fly less. So for this year's UN climate conference, I decided to make the climate-friendly choice and take a train. It seemed like it should be easy. This is Europe, after all, one of the most rail-connected places on Earth. But I soon discovered just how hard it can be to replace that $50 flight. First of all, just booking a long-distance ticket can be a challenge. So I decided to ask train guru Mark Smith for help.
Certainly. Berlin to Madrid shouldn't be a problem.
Smith runs the site seat61.com, which helps travelers navigate the European rail system.
Well, I've always been traveling around Europe on trains, but it's often difficult to book and difficult to find out about.
For instance, to get from Berlin to Madrid, I'll need to book seats on 4 different trains, in 3 different national railway systems, on 2 different websites. And it'll take 2 days, partly because railways have eliminated many of Europe's overnight trains to save money.
There aren't any sleeper trains on this route anymore, so you need to have an overnight stop in Paris.
Finally, there's the price.
Well, Berlin to Paris at this short notice is €217. Paris to Barcelona, again at this short notice, is about €107. And Barcelona to Madrid, another €107.
If you're keeping track at home, that's €431, or almost $480. Compare that with my $50 plane ticket. It would have been cheaper if I'd been able to book months in advance, but even then, multiple city-to-city train trips will almost always cost more than a single flight. Advocates say this is a failure of wider EU rail policy.
Although the European Union now is working very well in many areas in the railway sector, it doesn't.
That's Markus Sievers with the Alliance for Rail in Germany. He points out that most European rail lines are owned by national governments and historically focused within their own borders.
We have national organizations, and they don't work really together properly.
The result, he says, is a system that's harder to navigate and more expensive than it should be.
People want to use the trains because they have a lot of advantages, but the service has to get much, much better.
Ultimately, he says, for long-distance train service to compete with flying, airline tickets will have to be more expensive and train tickets less so. Germany has taken small steps in this direction. The government has proposed cutting taxes on train tickets and increasing taxes on plane tickets. And the EU is also thinking about encouraging more rail travel to meet the continent's climate targets. As for me, I bought my ticket and set out on the first leg of my journey, from Berlin to Paris via Cologne.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome aboard the ICE to Düsseldorf in Cologne Central Station.
But in Paris, I ran into a force maybe even more unstoppable than climate change.
Now to France, where massive strikes across the country are underway this morning. Train lines and schools are shut down. Flights canceled.
A major strike shut down most trains across France, and the national operator stopped taking online reservations. By the time I arrived in Paris, it was clear there was no chance of getting on one of the few trains still running towards Spain.
Señores pasajeros, bienvenidos a Madrid, donde hemos aterrizado.
And so, listener, I flew.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Madrid, where we have landed earlier than scheduled.
My flight for the second half of my trip from Paris to Madrid cost $106 and took a little over 2 hours. It's about half the price of the train and one-fifth the time. It also emitted about 500 pounds of carbon dioxide, which will remain in the atmosphere long after I'm gone, warming the planet just a little bit more. For The World, I'm Rachel Waldholz, finally in Madrid.
We inform you that we will arrive at gate J44.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. In Oslo today, Ethiopia's prime minister accepted his Nobel Peace Prize. But this Ethiopian activist tells me this story is not so simple. Would you say that Abiy Ahmed deserves a Nobel Peace Prize today?
Not today. He deserves for what he did the first 6 to 9 months.
That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH Boston, and PRX. Ethiopia's Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed received his Nobel Peace Prize today in Oslo.
Sustaining peace is hard work, yet we must cherish and nurture it. It takes a few to make war, but it takes a village and a nation to build peace.
Abiy won the 2019 prize for his peacemaking efforts that ended 2 decades of hostility between Ethiopia and Eritrea. But back home, things are not exactly as peaceful as Abiy's peace prize might seem to suggest. Jawar Mohammed is an Ethiopian activist credited with helping to bring Abiy to power. He's now quite critical of the prime minister. And that, Jawar told me, got him in trouble with government security forces a couple of months ago.
During the day, the prime minister spoke in parliament, threatening myself and the media I manage. That did create some level of tension. They sent security forces to remove. The government provided security detail that are housed at my house, and that led to a standoff between my security and the government security.
Why were you threatened?
I've become increasingly critical of the way he managed the transition here. He refused to engage the various political actors, the opposition, the different ethnic elites. Instead, he increasingly began concentrating power into his own hands, now willing to listen to feedbacks and critical voices. And we started some early sign of authoritarianism as some of his closest allies came under threat and intimidation for voicing concern on how the transition is being managed. And I felt that I needed to add my critical voice. Initially, I tried to deal with him on a personal level. Then I began to write and speak about the wrongdoing and the mistakes that are being committed. That did not seem to go down well with him. And in the parliament, he leveled that threat, which was not expected by the public, but we did not expect it to escalate that quickly. So it wasn't nothing personal. We have a good personal relationship, but I have increasingly become critical of the way he has been managing the transition.
So you're of the Oromo ethnic group, Jawar. I take it Ethiopians look up to you. Are you seen as a leader within your Oromo community or across the whole country?
I and the young people here played a central role in bringing the change that has taken place in this country. I was the chief strategist for the peaceful protest that brought this change. So the majority of the young people, the various communities in this country do look up to me and other leaders, being responsible and being able to bring the change. And that's why I felt that I needed to speak up, I needed to challenge him, and I needed to pressure him to go back on track to transition the country to democracy.
If the prime minister stays on that track of repression, as you say, what are you most afraid of?
My worst case scenario is a civil war. This country is very fragile. It does not have the shoulder to carry any more dictatorship. The worst case scenario, and which is very likely if you continue to rely on intimidation and repression, is a breakout of civil war. And a breakout of civil war in a country of 76 or so ethnic groups with no strong national institution is a nightmare situation. This country resembles Yugoslavia quite a lot.
The former Yugoslavia, yeah.
And we don't want the repetition of the Yugoslavia here, because the implication won't be just in Ethiopia. It will be on this troubled region of Horn of Africa as well as the Red Sea area. So I think the international community, the regional players are very much worried, and I see them getting involved, increasingly raising alarm, and hopefully that will help us go back on track and transition to democracy.
And yet, Abiy Ahmed's also been credited with bringing many progressive reforms to Ethiopia. There's the peace deal with Eritrea, for one. That was a big one. Also, his pledge to strengthen democracy and an appointment of a gender-balanced cabinet. So how do you factor those achievements into his record?
Yes, the first 6 to 9 months of his premiership was wonderful. Definitely, these are some wonderful things he has done. But over the last year, we saw him fail time and again to manage domestic issues.
Would you say that Abiy Ahmed deserves a Nobel Peace Prize today?
Not today. He deserves for what he did the first 6 to 9 months.
There has been speculation that you're going to run against Abiy Ahmed as prime minister. Is that true? Are you running?
I am running for election, but I have not decided for which post. My interest is in the process. I'm one of the influential people in this country, and I wanted to make sure my influence goes on the side of the opposition to provide a balance so that we will have not only a peaceful election, but also a competitive one. If his platform, his agendas are accepted by the public, they can give him the vote to renew his mandate. If not, they will give us the mandate, and we will provide the alternative leadership we believe this country deserves.
Jawar Mohammed is an Ethiopian activist credited with bringing Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed to power. Jawar is now critical of him. Thank you very much for speaking with us, Jawar.
Thank you.
This year's Nobels are caught up with another controversy. The winner of the 2019 Nobel Prize for Literature has brought some sharp protest. The award went to the Austrian author Peter Handke. He was recognized for his, quote, linguistic ingenuity in writing about the human experience. When the award was first announced this fall, Handke said it brought him feelings of peace, quiet, and freedom.
In a good way, not only in a bad way. I was astonished, yes. It was very courageous by the Swedish Academy.
Courageous, Handke called the Swedish Academy, but again, controversial too, because Handke supported the Serbian side in the war in the Balkans during the 1990s. He's accused of diminishing Serbian war crimes in his writing. One Nobel Committee for Literature member argued that Handke's support for the late Serbian strongman Slobodan Milosevic has been misunderstood. Another committee member, Rebecca Karda, said his writing on Yugoslavia should be taken together with 70 other books he's written. Based on that, she said, Peter Handke, quote, absolutely deserves a Nobel Prize. Clearly, though, not everyone agrees.
I don't really know what the proper word is. I suppose disgust.
This is journalist Peter Moss. He reported on the war in the Balkans. Today, he was in Stockholm following Bosnian protesters upset with the choice of Hanka as a Nobel Prize winner. Peter Moss sent us these thoughts.
The disgust that people who know what happened in Bosnia have at this moment, and that includes journalists who covered the war, and I am one of them. Many of us have taken to social media today to post our memories, our stories, our photographs of what we saw during the war in the early 1990s. The main justification for giving the Nobel Literature Prize to Peter Handke is that literature is supposed to be considered separate from politics. The argument, however, isn't even relevant in the case of Peter Handke, because his beliefs, his genocide-denying beliefs, are in his work. Among his books, there are about a half dozen that are about or relate to the former Yugoslavia, in which these ideas that have caused so much revulsion are present and are explicit. There is, in this case, no separation from the beliefs of Peter Handke and the work of Peter Handke. They are quite clearly, evidently, on the written page, together, one and the same. Where does this end? I don't know, but I certainly hope it doesn't end with denial.
Journalist Peter Moss on why he opposes today's Nobel Prize for Literature given to Austrian writer Peter Handke. When you're buying groceries on the way home today or waiting in the TSA line at the airport, take a moment to remember George Laurer. He was the American engineer who invented a laser scanner that made barcodes a part of daily life. Laurer died at 94.
Are those microwave dinners any good?
I don't know.
I'll give them a whirl.
Kevin, in Home Alone, casually buying his groceries. When the scanner and barcode first arrived on the scene in the mid-70s, it was pretty futuristic.
Ruby red laser beam is concealed inside a window in the checkout counter. The clerk pulls each item past the window, and the laser spots one of those mysterious patches of squiggles and digits about the size of a postage.
The barcode's first commercial uses were in American supermarkets.
And now they're everywhere. That's Deborah Sugg Ryan. She's a professor of design history at the University of Portsmouth in the UK. The supermarket scanner sped up checkouts, wiped out the need for individual price stickers, also befuddled at least one American president. And before long, Sugg Ryan says the barcode scanner became part of nearly every commercial interaction we have.
Tickets, when we're posting parcels, it's used. Or if you go into hospital, you'll have a barcode affixed to you. So it has this kind of ubiquity, which I think is kind of hard to replace.
Not just hard to replace. Laurer's invention completely transformed how businesses operate.
It really helps the supermarket with logistics and supply chain to make sure that it had the right products at the right time. But of course, it's also gathering information about us as customers as well.
So the stores know what kind of toilet paper we prefer, for example, which is the creepy part of barcodes. And now they are inescapable, from the ISBN numbers on books to QR codes. It all goes back to George Laurer and his colleagues at IBM in 1973. You may not have heard his name before, but his work beeps on. The world's biggest oil producer is going public. The Saudi Arabian oil company, also known as Aramco, is offering a small percentage of its shares on the market. Investors can get their hands on the company's shares through the Saudi Stock Exchange starting tomorrow. This will kick off a new era for a company that is state-owned and historically very insular. Here's the world's Shirin Jafari.
Saudi Aramco is the most profitable company in the world, more profitable than Apple, Google, or Walmart. Ellen Wald is the author of Saudi Inc., a book about the history of Aramco. And she says it's hard to overstate the company's role in making Saudi Arabia what it is today.
Aramco is the most important company in Saudi Arabia. In many respects, it is the entire reason that Saudi Arabia has become such a wealthy and successful kingdom.
Aramco started out as an American company, says Walt, owned by four major American shareholders.
In 1980, it was fully sold to the government of Saudi Arabia. In 1988, becoming Saudi Aramco, which is the company that we know it as today.
Today, Aramco is worth $1.7 trillion. That's trillion with a T. And it makes most of its money by pumping oil out of the ground and selling it to the rest of us. So why is the crown jewel of Saudi Arabia, a state-owned oil company, going public now?
Oil production is going to become less and less of an interesting business.
Philip Cornell worked for Aramco from 2014 to 2016 and is now with the Atlantic Council.
And the issue for Saudi Arabia is how quickly can they, let's say, front-end their value and try to leverage their national assets, including Saudi Aramco, and pump that money into programs that might diversify the economy.
Cornell says realistically, global oil consumption is not going to die out completely anytime soon. But companies are concerned about long-term prospects of fossil fuels.
The advancement of things like electric vehicles and other kind of substitutions for oil mean that demand could start to weaken even in this decade.
Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman knows this. He has laid out plans to reduce the kingdom's reliance on oil and expand other non-oil sectors. He's pouring money into tourism, entertainment, and technology. It's not clear exactly where the Saudi government will invest the money from the Aramco IPO, says Ellen Wald.
They do say they want to diversify their economy. Whether or not the sale of shares of Aramco will be able to accomplish this diversification is a major, major question and also a major risk.
But it's a risk that the Saudi state is willing to take. In the meantime, environmentalists are concerned that money raised in this IPO will allow the oil giant to expand. Patrick McCulley is with the Rainforest Action Network, an environmental organization based in San Francisco. He argues Aramco is already big enough.
Aramco is the single largest carbon polluter on the planet. Studies show that it is responsible for the emissions of more carbon dioxide than anyone else.
Last October, a study found that Aramco was responsible for nearly 5% of all global greenhouse gas emissions in the past half century. It produced 13 million barrels of oil a day in the first half of this year. That's more than four times what ExxonMobil produced. McCulley sent a letter to the CEOs of the banks that are involved in Aramco's public offering, criticizing their role in the sale. Nine other environmental groups signed it.
The banks need to start putting some serious pressure on the fossil fuel industry, and that means sending a very clear signal by not getting involved. If there is a long-term financial future, that's going to be at the expense of the planet.
The banks didn't respond to the letter, but McCulley says environmental concerns, as well as Saudi Arabia's human rights records, have dampened investors' interest in Aramco. Initially, it planned to sell 3% of the shares, but now it is scaled back to only 1.5%. It also wanted to list its shares on the international stock exchanges, like in London or in New York. But now the sale is only limited to the Saudi Stock Exchange.
Distinguished speaker here today. So please join me in welcoming Amin Nasser.
Aramco did not respond to an interview request. But at a recent conference in London, the company's CEO, Amin Nasser, acknowledged concerns about oil and climate change.
Without a doubt, oil and gas will be here for many decades to come, but there can also be no question that climate change is among the most significant challenges facing humanity.
But Nasser went on to say that governments should come up with a more holistic approach to reducing their carbon footprint and not just focus on the oil industry. Meanwhile, Ellen Wald, the author of Saudi Inc., predicts tomorrow's sale will likely push Aramco to produce more oil. That's because as a listed company, it will want to increase revenue to attract more investors in the future. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
If the polls are right, Boris Johnson and his Conservative Party are looking like the clear winners in Thursday's election in the UK. The polls, as we know, can be wrong, so the Tories, as Johnson's party members are called, have a strategy. They're targeting districts that voted yes for Brexit and also happen to be traditional strongholds for the opposition Labour Party. In British political speak, these areas are known as the Labour-Leave heartlands. In a recording leaked to a news website this morning, a key Labour Party figure, John Ashworth, even expressed serious doubts about his own party and its leader, Jeremy Corbyn.
You know, if you're in sort of small town Midlands and North, it's abysmal out there. I mean, they don't like Johnson, but they can't stand Corbyn and they think Labour's blocked Brexit.
Ashworth later dismissed these leaked comments as quote-unquote banter. But what does it look like in these small towns?
I went to Windy, Yorkshire, Marco. West Yorkshire, to be more specific, and a place called Wakefield.
The World's Orla Barry has been out in one of these key Labour constituencies today.
Yorkshire itself is a rural county. It's the biggest county in England. It's a county that has the Yorkshire Moors, and people will think of the Bronte sisters and Jane Eyre and all of that, and they think of Yorkshire. But also places like Wakefield were real mining towns and mining hubs. And in the 1980s, when the mines were closed under the Thatcher government, people were very angry, and they were Labour supporters up to then, but they were very strongly Labour supporters after that because they saw the Conservatives as ruining their local economy.
But today, Orla, when you got down to the ground there in Yorkshire, what was it actually like in terms of the upcoming elections?
Well, it's interesting. You know, we are coming up to Christmas. It's a terrible time to be out canvassing. It's also not great weather to be out campaigning either. Again, you know, the issues that John Ashworth mentioned in the tape there, they did come up on the doorstep. The issues of Brexit, the issues of Jeremy Corbyn, the issues of Boris Johnson. But that said, I joined the Labour Party on their canvas.
If you give me a little handful of my leaflets.
So which Labour candidate did you go out with today?
Mary Cray, she's a Labour MP and she's held the seat there for a number of years. So I suspect some of the doors that they were calling to were very specifically Labour doors and Labour targets. And I'll give you an example. This is one door that we called on. Have a listen to what they had to say.
Hello, is it Mr. Chamberlain?
Yeah, ma'am.
It's Mary Cray, I'm the Labour candidate at the election. Are you voting on Thursday?
Yes. I'm voting Labour.
Great, thank you very much. Can I shake hands with you? That's marvellous.
Tell me why.
Because I don't want the Tories, and I think they're despicable, loathsome people. Will that do you?
Have you always voted Labour?
Yes.
And do you worry when you look at this constituency, they say there's only maybe 2,000 votes between Labour and the Conservatives. Does it worry you?
It does a bit, but usually, I mean, it's usually been a safe seaters, but things are looking a touch iffy at the moment, yeah, but we're living hope.
Why do you think people are edging towards the Conservatives who mightn't have done before?
I think it's the Brexit thing for a start, and also a lot of people don't like Corbyn. I think that's the main two reasons, I'd have thought, yeah.
Do you like Corbyn?
Yeah, I think he's quite a good fella, actually, yeah, I do. I like the way I also like if he does get in power, he's going to shake things up and get some people worried, which is always good.
Yeah, but it sounds like not all traditional Labour voters in Yorkshire, Orla, feel the same.
No, indeed. And actually, it should be said, by the way, Marco, Mary Cray, the Labour MP herself, who's running for re-election, she has been critical of Corbyn in the past. She's a really staunch Remainer. And Corbyn, as we know, has been quite wishy-washy about the whole Brexit business. And I should say, Marco, it does sound as if, you know, the voters that I met today were all supportive of Mary and the Labour Party, etc. But they weren't all. There was one voter who took particular umbrage with Jeremy Corbyn. Take a listen.
And he's not but a communist, but you know, you're too young to remember.
So what you're hearing there, and it's quite hard to hear him, I understand he has quite a strong local accent, is that Jeremy Corbyn is a communist and he's a terrorist. And I guess this is one of the slurs that gets thrown at Corbyn. You know, he's an avowed socialist and has been very outspoken about it over the years. But what the gentleman there is referring to is Northern Ireland. And Jeremy Corbyn in the past has supported the end of British rule in Northern Ireland, and he'd met the leaders of Sinn Féin and other Republicans in the 80s and 90s. And this has often come back up against him.
So tomorrow's the final day of campaigning before the Thursday vote. What about that old undecided vote? Are people firm in their decisions right now and ready?
Not at all. I heard one pollster saying earlier that he has never come across so many undecided voters in decades. And I think that's absolutely true. I mean, one poll I saw said 13% of voters are undecided. Another said 40% of voters are undecided. So while, you know, you said at the start, the polls are telling us that the Tories are heading towards a big victory, reality is, Marco, we really don't know. There's so many undecideds out there that they could change things and send the votes either way.
The World's Orla Barry, thanks very much.
Thanks, Marco.
And while we're on the subject, it's worth mentioning how frequently a certain romantic comedy keeps coming up in the UK election campaign. Love Actually, the 2003 Christmas classic where Hugh Grant plays the British Prime Minister, falls in love with his assistant and in one scene goes door to door in her neighborhood looking for her.
Hello. Is Natalie it?
Hugh Grant reprised that role this week, going door to door to encourage UK voters to support the Liberal Democrats, which triggered a Love Actually theme in the campaign. Boris Johnson responded, also spoofing Love Actually. You know, that scene where Keira Knightley opens the door to a young man, played by Andrew Lincoln.
Oh, hi.
Who is it?
It's carol singers.
It's not carolers, of course. It's a young man struck by unrequited love playing music from a boombox and holding up signs admitting to a secret crush on the girl. In Boris Johnson's version...
Hi.
Who is it?
It's carol singers.
Johnson holds up cards to a woman at a door that say she has a choice to make between a working majority or another gridlocked hung parliament arguing about Brexit. Well, that's certainly less romantic than the original. Hugh Grant came back with this.
One of the cards from the original film that he didn't hold up was the one where Andrew Lincoln held up a card saying, "Because at Christmas you tell the truth." And I just wonder if the spin doctors in the Tory party thought that was a card that wouldn't look too great in Boris Johnson's hands.
Boris Johnson's last word on the politics of Love Actually is what he often says about Brexit.
Enough. Enough. Let's get this done.
This, the vote anyway, will be done on Thursday, UK Election Day.